Thanks for tuning into Journey. Everyone is welcome at the table. We are a community being shaped by Jesus, experiencing and practicing humility, curiosity, belonging, and generosity. We hope to be a people who embrace the way of Jesus by listening first, speaking second, loving freely, and giving generously.
And, bear witness is one of the ways, an invitation to the church to reclaim what made the church so revolutionary in its first few decades. The church was not filled with a bunch of people who'd gone through evangelism training and could share the Romans Road or something. The early church, there were evangelists and apostles who would preach, and then they would form churches, and then the invitation of those churches was to live in an upside-down social reality that was birthed by the fact that Jesus had risen from the dead. And there were certain things that were true of that community that still echo years later. One of the things that was true of them is that they were a community of shalom, of justice. We're going to talk about that next week. They were a community of hope. We'll talk about that the week after. But today we want to focus on the idea that they were a community of generosity, that one of the things the resurrection meant for them is they took care of each other. So we're just going to start by looking at some texts from the records of the early church and noticing how resurrection for them wasn't just some floaty idea about heaven someday. Resurrection meant that we take care of each other. So Acts chapter 2, very famously, Peter's ending up his first sermon, and it's gone pretty well, let's be honest. Acts chapter 2, verse 40, with many other words, Peter warned the people he was preaching to. He pleaded with them, save yourselves from this corrupt generation. Those who accepted his message were baptized, and about 3,000 were added to their number that day. Now, what did they do in response to this preaching? Well, they devoted themselves to the teaching of the apostles. These were the people with Jesus. And to fellowship, which meant they spent a lot of time together. To the breaking of bread, this is a reference to communion, and to prayer. Everyone was filled with awe at the many wonders and signs performed by the apostles. All the believers were together and had everything in common. They sold property and possessions to give to anyone who had need. Now, it's interesting, like prayer makes sense that you'd mention that, apostolic teaching makes sense, but one of the things that's continually pulled forward when you talk about the early church is how generous they were with each other. Evidently, the resurrection of Jesus meant that you didn't have to hoard anymore, but you could share. And so all the believers were together, had everything in common. They sold property to give to anyone who had need. I find that just extremely interesting, that of all the things that you could say about the early church, this is one consistent refrain that we get throughout almost all of the descriptions. In Acts chapter 4, all the believers, verse 32, were one in heart and mind. No one claimed that any of their possessions was their own, but they shared everything they had. And all the communists in our community said yes. With great power, the apostles continued to testify to what? To the resurrection of Jesus. And God's grace was so powerfully at work in them all that there were no needy persons. That was the evidence that God's grace was among them, is that there were no needy persons among them. From time to time, those who'd owned land or houses sold them and brought money from the sales and put it at the apostles' feet, and it was distributed to anyone who had need. So, of all the ways you could talk about the countercultural nature of the early church, one of the things that gets repeatedly mentioned is that they were testifying to the resurrection, they were bearing witness to the resurrection by how they took care of each other in very tangible financial ways. In Acts 6, in those days when the number of disciples was increasing, the Hellenistic Jews, these are the Greek-speaking Jews, among them complained against the Hebrew-speaking Jews that their widows were being overlooked in the daily distribution of food. Now, we'll talk about that disagreement next week, but just notice that one of the things that the resurrection meant for them is they had a daily distribution of food, and the widows were on that list. Notice Acts chapter 11. During this time, some prophets came down from Jerusalem to Antioch. One of them named Agabus, stood up and through the Spirit predicted that a severe famine would spread over the entire Roman world. This happened during the reign of Claudius. The disciples, and then what's this next phrase? As each, say it. Thank you. Decided to provide help for the brothers and sisters living in Judea. So we're gonna see a theme about as each one was able, but just notice that for now. But hey, we receive advance warning from God there's gonna be famine. So what does the resurrection community do? The resurrection community raises money to meet the need. And in fact, Paul, in almost, I don't know if it's half of his letters, it's probably, half of his letters talks to each of the Gentile churches about raising money for the church in Jerusalem who was affected by this famine. Like, it's his big thing. In fact, in 1 Corinthians, Paul, 1 Corinthians 15 is all about the resurrection of Jesus. And he closes with these colossally large ideas about Jesus overcoming death. 1 Corinthians 15, verse 54. When the perishable body has been clothed with the imperishable body, and when the mortal body has been clothed with immortality, then the saying that is written will come true. Death has been swallowed up in victory. And then here's the taunt. Oh, death, where is your victory? Death, where is your sting? The sting of death is sin. The power of sin is law. But thanks be to God, he gives us victory through our Lord Jesus Christ. Like, you could not get bigger and better news than this. And then there is no paragraph break, chapter break. It's now about the collection for God's people. Like, there's just no, he's still talking about the same thing. Do what I told the Galatian churches to do. On the first day of every week, each one of you should set aside a sum of money in keeping with your income. Say that again. In keeping with your income. Say that one more time. In keeping with your income. Saving it up so that when I come, no collections will have to be made. All right. So, and we could look at other things. I have many other slides that we're not going to look at. Even from Roman emperors in the 4th century who were complaining that the reason Christians, so many people were coming to Christ was because the church provided for the Roman poor instead of the Roman government. I mean, it was just one of the things that was so true of the early church, that was one of the central ways they bore witness to the reality of the resurrection, was that they took care of each other in their walls and outside of their walls. So, beyond a shadow of a doubt, they bore witness to the resurrection of Jesus, not by thinking it's some floaty idea of the afterlife, but rather they actually used money to provide for each other. So, when we, a couple thousand years later, talk about money, how great is that conversation? Yeah, in the church. How great is that? Who says, hey, it's Money Sunday, let's go? No. But guess what today is? It's Money Sunday! Yes! So, I want to hear that muttering. I want to hear the muttering. I want to hear it. So, let's distinguish. I've got a bunch of disclaimers. So, let's distinguish between the church as an organism and the church as an organization. All right? Fire up those slides, Joe. So when I say organism, the church is a living and breathing thing. It's the body of Christ made up of everyone who is Jesus's throughout the world forever. That is the body of Christ. And that body is indestructible. That body is not threatened by pandemics. It's not affected by economic growth or slowdowns. It doesn't care what president's in the White House or who sits on the Supreme Court or what laws are enacted or not. This is indestructible, it's inevitable, it will, the way a mustard seed starts small and then slowly takes over an entire field, this kingdom will continue to progress no matter what human beings do to try to ignore it or oppose it. Correct? Does that church need your money? Heck no. God looks at Israel and all the sacrifices they give and is like, "What? Do you think I need your cattle? I have cattle on 1,000 hills, guys. Really? Really? I'm up there going, well, you know, I have a $1 trillion budget for this year in 2024 for America. I hope those Christians are really, I mean, how absurd to think those sorts of things. So if it's not for God, then who's it for? Well, it's for two things. Number one, it's for the organization. The church in America, at its best, is an organism. At its worst, is only another nonprofit that has budgets and lights and salaries, and you got to pay for all of that. And so we fundraise, because we got to pay the bills. And the people who are the chief fundraisers are the people whose salaries are paid by the people giving the money, right? So this has been horribly corrupting in the American church, because we either over talk about money and make grand promises about how God will bless you if you give it to me, or because of those people, we just don't say anything at all. And we ignore the fact that the Bible, it's like of central concern. So everything you have heard about Christian abuses of money is true, and it's awful. And so when we talk about generosity, I just want to start from a place of saying, I, like you, have been horribly disenchanted by the organization called the American Church. And it's a very fair question why you would trust any church with your money. So let's just acknowledge that. And let me also say this. And I say this as a joke, but seriously, I can go back to modeling. Right? There's why did you look at him like that? You were like, no, you looked at him like, like he could do it too? That seems like that's stretching the truth just a little bit. I don't know. I'm looking at both of us. But I appreciate your heart. Bless your heart, as they say, as I've learned. So those are the disclaimers, okay? Everything I'm about to say has been misused, abused, manipulated, coercive. It's awful. It's awful. And yet, it is still true that we form spiritual bonds with our stuff, and that those spiritual bonds need to be held up to the light of the kingdom like every other thing that we do. So I'm just going to be super honest and straightforward and talk about how much I struggle with this, and realize this is not in any way, shape, or form a guilt, fear, condemnation conversation. This is a joy and liberation conversation if it's done right. Because I don't give because the church needs to keep the lights on. I don't give because God needs the money. I give because I desperately want to be somebody and to be a part of a community that resists the prevailing powers and principalities of our world that define human life in terms of success, efficiency, and material goods. Because I have a son named Seth who has Down syndrome, and he will not produce anything for the market. And he is the most worthy of praise of any human I know. So I want to live a kind of resistant, joy-filled life that isn't enslaved to how the market's doing today. I care about it, absolutely, because that little critter, I still want to save a whole bunch of money for so his brothers and sister can take care of him. So I care deeply about financial things. And I also know how easily I can justify my idolatry in that realm, right? Yes, this yacht I'm going to use for ministry. Yes. And there are people who do use yachts for ministry. Hallelujah. But I just know my heart would, you know, have an easy time justifying that now. So I want to take 15 minutes, and I want to just go through one text that speaks to me. And then I want to go through a set of slides that kind of give an entire overview of the New Testament's teaching about money. And then let's do questions. And if you were like last service, there were plenty. All right? So the passage that comes to my mind when I think about the New Testament teaching on money is 1 Timothy 6. So let's fire that up. And it begins this way: command those who are rich in this present world. Now, when you hear the phrase rich in this present world, how many of you think of somebody else? Absolutely. Yeah, Jesus, those rich people need to get their act together. Right? And then I type my income into the Global Poverty Index calculator. And according to that thing, I'm in the top 6% of humans that have ever lived. And the fact that it doesn't feel that way shows how demonic our world really is. The fact that I, with two TVs, right, four cars, because our dumb kids drive cars, and a savings account, don't think I'm rich, that shows you how insidious the whole system is. Now, is there real poverty in America? You bet. And is there real poverty in our church? You bet. And if you're here and you can barely keep your head above water, God's invitation to you is to keep treading water, get out of debt, do your best, right? The invitation is not for you to learn generosity by giving everything away so that you get further into debt, right? I'm talking about the people like me who want to think about other people who are rich, when according to the text, I should be thinking about me. Does that make sense? That's a bunch of us here. So, command me, one who is rich in this present world, not to be arrogant, right? And that's why I dress so simply. I just don't want to be arrogant. These are my winter shoes. So these are my winter shoes. Nor, I don't need you chirping about pedicures, love. That is a waste of God's money. I'm telling you that right now. The controversy starts already. Nor to be arrogant, nor to what? Put there? Hope. Now, here's the thing about money that the Bible teaches. Money is never about money. Money is about hope, trust, fear management, anxiety management, right? Control. Money is never about money. One of the big lies that I was taught is that money is neutral and it's just something to be used. And Jesus taught, nope, money has a magnetic force. And by money, I don't just mean cash. I mean possessions, stuff, belongings, the whole package. And if we're really honest, we all recognize that. I recognize that and feel that most specifically in airports. If they lose my luggage, all of a sudden, I'm going to miss those things more than any, you know, like anything I've ever missed before. If somehow my luggage is misplaced, I don't know. I have four mystic bonds to my stuff. And so the invitation is to not put hope in that. And again, it's so easy to say. But one of the reasons why the scriptures invite us to assume a posture of generosity is because I'm actually warring against the hope that I have in wealth. And that hope, by the way, is so uncertain, if you put it there. But rather, back to 1 Timothy, put your hope in God. And then here's the line that Tim referenced. Who richly provides us with everything for our enjoyment. I don't look at God like that. I see the world as a place of scarcity and competition. So I've got to get mine, right? God isn't going to just shower me with a salary, I have to go grab it, right? God isn't up there saying, hey, it doesn't matter if you need an advanced degree or not, right? I'm just going to go ahead and give you the knowledge that an advanced degree would give you. So I come from a place where I look at the world and I do not look at God as someone who richly provides us everything for our enjoyment. I look at God as a God I have to buy off in order to be blessed by him. And that is so different from how Paul and Jesus talk about the God of the scriptures, right? The God of abundance, the God who enjoys blessing regardless of whether or not you bless back. Command the rich people, me, to do good, to be rich in good deeds, to be generous and willing to share. How broad is that? Is that just money? No, generosity is like a whole way of living. And in this way, they will lay up treasure for themselves as a firm foundation for the coming age, so they, me, might take hold of the life that is truly life. I've been around rich people who are greedy, and I've been around poor people who are generous. I've been around people that give 10% of their income, and they do it to buy God off. And I've been around people who give 1% of their income, and they're the most generous people you've ever met. There is nothing we're going to talk about that is some sort of percentage that you have to, like a line you've got to cross. Three times, Paul has the opportunity to instruct Gentile believers to give a percentage, and he never does. Give according to your means. Give as you decide in your heart. It's Can any percentage capture that? No. So anytime you hear somebody pounding you with Old Testament passages about robbing God because you're not giving your tithe, hasn't read their New Testament well enough. This is a liberation conversation. This is not a slavery, joyless conversation. That's why Paul will say, listen, you actually could do this out of gladness, which sounds, you know, foreign to me. All right. Are you out there? Okay, so far. All right, it's going to get worse. Now, I want to very quickly answer several questions. Why should we give? Why give to a church? Why should we talk about this in church? And then how should we do it? And this is just summarizing New Testament teaching, and then we'll do questions, because I can feel them. All right, why should we give? Number one, because all we have is God's. We are only managers of his resources and are held accountable for how we use our lives and possessions. Man, that comes, if you ever want Jesus' take on possessions, read Luke. One in every three lines is about managing the possessions of the absent king. It's incredible. Number two, it's an act of worship, right? God, not the church, is the object of giving. Number three, I don't know about you, but my heart is attached to my treasuring. So beyond meeting our physical needs, how we spend money shows what we really treasure. And redirecting, like where we spend money, redirects our treasurings. So the idea, at least for me, is because I form mystic bonds with bank accounts and portfolios and possessions, one of the ways I war against those mystic bonds is by taking some of that and giving it away with no strings attached. Number four, and this is the doozy for us, greed and unqualified accumulation are resoundingly condemned in the Bible. There are more warnings about wealth than any other ethical subject in the New Testament, which is really ironic, because they were poor, most of them. And money is the only rival God that Jesus mentions by name. Oof. In fact, it's such a, number five, it's such a central part of discipleship that Jesus said many disciples are choked because of the deceitfulness of wealth. Number six, generosity shows my appreciation to God who ultimately gave me everything. It's kind of like, yeah, but look at what I've done with the brain you've given me. Yeah, but who gave you the brain? Yep, okay, you're fair. That's fair. Number seven, it breaks the power of mammon, which was this Aramaic word for the deity of money. So money has a gravitational pull. And if you don't believe that, just try giving it away and see how you feel. And then number eight, there is a unqualified, absolute mandate to assist the poor. Why should we give to a church, right? Because generosity is so much bigger than giving to a church, correct? So why would you do it to a church, particularly when we're all jacked up? The New Testament offers the following rationale. Number one, to be a regular participant in church life. This, like, we're forming a certain kind of community together. Number two, to surrender the right to control where my money goes. There have to be some places where I give money and don't control always how it's used. Number three, and this is why we went through those Acts passages, to demonstrate resurrection life, to build a countercultural community of people who stand. I mean, the world knows what we're against, but we don't very often show the world what we're for. Joy, simplicity, right? Generosity, kindness, humility, like that's what we're for. Number four, to support the ministry of the local church. Giving provides a basis for our institutional, organizational life. Why does Journey mention this? Well, to increase maturity in this area. No one starts out by earning a salary and thinking, I can't wait to give away most of this. Right? I graduated college and went, finally. And I had this weird experience where I graduated as a financial investment guy. So I graduated with a degree in finance. I worked for I was an investment banker, and I was in line to make six figures, back when six figures meant something, okay? And I was a part of this little church, and this little church was looking for a youth pastor, and they could pay $17,000. And they said, hey, do you want that job? And I said, absolutely not. And then I made the mistake of saying, hey, God, I don't know if you have a will about this, but if you do, what do you think? And the text that came into my mind was the text from Matthew where Jesus says, you cannot serve both God and money. And I realized that for me, I would not be able to make that much money and not serve it. So I took the youth pastor job. About 2 weeks in, I got my first paycheck of nothing. And my senior pastor shows up to me and he's like, hey, let's talk about tithing. And I was like, bro, I just tithe $83,000 at the door by taking this dumb job. Are you kidding me? I'm not giving 1 cent of this. This is hardly enough to live on. What are you talking about, tithing? Good Lord, still burns me. But I was young and naive and full of Holy Spiritness, and so I said, okay, let's start tithing. And the dumbest thing began to happen. I was surprised by how God would meet provision in my life. And there was no formula. It wasn't like the pastors on TV that say, give me your seed money and you'll get four times back. I mean, what a bunch of idiots. Yeah, I get fired up about how people manipulate. This is awful. This is awful. But I did see God do interesting and random things I think I would have missed otherwise. And so for my wife and me, we've been on a journey to increase our maturity in this so that as our standard of living grows, our generosity grows too. Because I realized if I wasn't going to be generous with a little, I wasn't going to be generous with a lot. And so I look back now and I'm glad the pastor talked to me about that, even though I don't think a tithe is taught. And I think I should have had a grace period of 6 months to like just live in a really paltry salary. Anyway, so we just want to invite wherever you are. So again, for some of us, man, for some of us, it's just getting to the next paycheck. So don't feel guilt or shame about that. Like that's what you're doing. That's great. Get out of debt. Work. For others of us, we're in a situation in life where we have more disposable income. And then the issue is, well, what does increased generosity look like? Because obviously it's not money, but it certainly includes it. Number two, the reason we talk about money is we want to invite everyone to participate. If it's truly a core area of discipleship that I won't do naturally, then inviting and reminding is part of what we have to do together. Number three, to give in a systematic and organized way. If left to me, I'll conveniently forget to be generous. Number four, to create the kind of community that witnesses well to Jesus. Number five, we want to celebrate generosity so whatever you talk about becomes normal. And then number six, it's impossible to disciple consumers in the way of Jesus. And church, for many, myself included, has become another consumer product. Meaning we show up, we receive, and then we critique it like we would critique a movie. Did I like it? Was it good? Was it moving? And then if it was, I'll stick around and I'll tip. And it's kind of like the vision of the New Testament is a bit more robust than that. And then how do we give? Last two, and then we'll do questions. First of all, we give proportionately. The Bible never, ever, ever, ever teaches, the New Testament, I should say, never, ever teaches that there's some percentage you've got to meet. Because I've met people that give 10% and are still greedy, and I've met people that give much less and are incredibly generous. And then there's this weird teaching in 2 Corinthians about giving gladly. And I'm still working on that one, to be honest. Right? There are times I literally just have to give because I feel the mystic bonds pulling me. And I'm like, I have to stand in resistance to that. All right. I'll stop there. I have another little part we'll do after the Q&As, but let's do the Q's and the A's. And so, and if you don't want to talk about anything, great. I'm great. I'm fully licensed money manager. Can answer all your financial questions. Yeah. Anything you want to talk about? Oh, thanks. Yeah, cues. Oh, yeah. Yeah, remember the cues. Quick questions, concise. Questions?
Clarity.
Thank you. I'm rusty on the cues. Yes. Cut and color. Perfect.
Yeah, I'll definitely be quick. This is more of a comment, but you just mentioned gladly as one of those things.
Yeah.
If you get into a pattern of giving constantly, you've got to be careful about pride.
Oh, bro.
Because it becomes something that, you know what I mean?
Oh, I know what you mean.
It's a gateway for
that
sort of thing.
Yeah, absolutely. So you can almost be prideful about how generous you are. Totally. Yes. It's good. Thank you for picking that up. Anything else you want to talk about? Well, hello. Oh, now we're seeing it. Now we're going. Let's go.
So I struggle with this on the opposite end in that I'm a waitress, and so I live on 20%. Like, I'm always hoping for 20%.
Yes.
At least, right? Like, that's like...
Yeah.
And so when I don't get that, I like those people less. And that, like, bothers me. And
totally.
We talk about it at work all the time of like, yeah. Oh, jerks, like they left 10% and they sat for 4 hours and
totally.
Do they know that they cost me money and blah, blah, blah. And yeah. I don't know how to like get out of that mindset because I don't want to value the people based on what they left, but it is, you know what I mean?
Like, oh yeah. Yeah. So my daughter just started working at a restaurant in Western Kentucky and it's the same. You don't get paid anything hourly. It's all tips. And so she actually is a great tipper now for the first time in her life because she realizes. So how do you do that? I don't know. I don't have any idea. I'd feel the same way. And so I think one of the great things about Jesus people is the reminder that if they're going to see us pray before our meals and be all churchy, they should see us be very generous with people who help and can't benefit us. So one of the things about generosity that is super convicting to me is being generous to people who can't pay back. Simply in virtue of being generous. So how do you start to love those people? I don't know. I would feel very similar if someone took 4 hours of my time and didn't tip well. Or as my daughter says, they're like all 18 and they all write their phone numbers down and then don't tip. She's like, Do you think they're getting a call back? They're not getting a call back. So anyway, great question.
Does Journey Church have some sort of Barnabas fund or some sort of a way that we can say, I want to give this money, it's not earmarked necessarily, or sometimes it might be earmarked. Yeah. You've heard of a need and you want to give money to that need. How does that happen?
Yes, we do. You can give and you can say that that's what it's for. We call it benevolence. So anytime someone has like a real felt immediate need, like they can't pay a bill or they're out of a job and need food, like we do gift cards for grocery stores and all kinds of things like that. And we thankfully, because of the generosity of our community, we've been able to help out some people in the last year. It's been really great. Thank you for asking that.
Thank you, Dylan.
Hello, Michael.
Well, JJ, hello.
Speaking from your personal experience from turning down a really high-paying job to do something that did not pay highly, how can you realize when your career aspirations are an idol or when they're not?
Oh.
How do you address that?
Oh. Well, you make me sound far more heroic than I was. I could say that right now. And then secondly, pastoring became another form of the same idol, right? So I want to be influential. I want to be, you know, whatever. So does that happen with all of us? Yes, we just keep score differently. So pastors don't compare salaries, although some of the salaries are ridiculous. We compare book sales and church sizes and all, just the same awful stuff. So the way that God has been forming and shaping me away from that includes regular generosity that's both planned and spontaneous, lots of therapy about where my identity is really found and why it is that I chose to get into a profession that so easily performs, because I'm a performer. And so that whole combination has been really reshaping. So just because you want to do something doesn't mean it's bad. As my therapist says, sometimes our desires are there for good reasons and you can trust them. I want to measure the fruit of my way of living. Is the fruit of my way of living fear, control, anxiety, stress, ugliness, or is the fear of my way of living increasing joy, increasing generosity, increasing humility? And that's, so I wouldn't measure the job per se. I would measure how my attachment to that job has shaped the rest of my life. Does that make sense? Great question.
I have a question. Something that I struggle with consistently in terms of giving outside the church. Everywhere I go, I see people in the car when I'm stopped at a traffic light. And I'm from East Central Indiana, so I see it there, here, everywhere, with a sign up. They need help. They're homeless, whatever. I'm not to judge, but sometimes I'm like, it doesn't really look like it.
Right.
The way you're dressed. I do know there's people, as I tell the grandkids, with evil intent, and they get out there and do the stuff. They really don't need the money.
Totally.
Also, we're at a time where jobs are more abundant than in the past. I've lived long enough to see that. So there's that. And then I know the other day in a store, a young man came up, and I was an educator in my career. So, you know, I'm very into helping kids and that thing.
Yeah.
Teenage man come up and ask for money. And I kind of sensed you don't really need it.
Right.
But and again, who am I to judge? So that's part of the struggle.
Right.
Sometimes I take the coward's way out in terms of being a Christian and God. Okay, I'll pray with you, pray for you. And I asked this young man, are you a Christian? And he looked kind of ashamed. So, but again, and then I'm like, I always ask myself later, well, Lord, are you testing me with giving and my faith with this? You tell me, regardless, give to everybody, give what I give, everything I have, that kind of thing. So do you understand what I'm saying with the struggle?
Oh, yes.
And again, and then another time I'll throw this in and then I'll
throw
let
it
you
in.
Answer. There was a lady who I approached her. She was wanting money outside a grocery store. So I got to talking to her. She says, well, I need it for cigarettes. I says, ma'am, I cannot give you money for that. My dad died a terrible death of lung cancer from 50 years of smoking.
Yeah.
So, and I'm always concerned that maybe they're, you know, I'm actually buying their illegal drugs or whatever. So that's my question. How do we handle this situation as Christians? And how do we discern, is this God testing me? Am I being disobedient?
Okay. First of all, thank you. Because I'm sure that you're the only one in the room that wrestles with that. Secondly, I don't know that God tests us that way. I don't see him as I don't see him as scorekeeping in the way that testing suggests. Thirdly, I normally do not give to people who are asking on the side of the road. I used to until I went to Portland, and there is a very sophisticated network of care for people who really do want it that we don't have to duplicate. There are times, though, I was a chaplain for a police department in California that had a huge homeless problem, and I would go buy food. I would say, hey, you're sitting out of a restaurant. I'm going in here. What can I buy for you? And it just could be like 3 or 4 bottles of water or whatever. So I would not just hand cash over. The biggest thing for me was I want to be the kind of person who would give to somebody in need. And there were times when I felt like I would be intersected with somebody who could use that sort of spontaneous giving. And then there were other times I wasn't so sure. Mark, do you want to talk about that at all? And I know I'm putting you on the spot, but would you talk about that? So Mark heads up a thing called Room in the Inn that is part of a part of care for people who are displaced from regular housing. How do you answer that when people, because you know a lot of these folks, how do you answer that when people ask?
Yeah, people are generally, just like everybody in this room, are lacking more in relationships and actually having community than they are things. There is resources around this city, especially in Nashville, for people to get a meal, to be able to have access to all kinds of money, to access to housing, all kinds of things. But what they lack is community. And
that's a good word, dude.
So what we just even try to do through shelter here. The shelter part that we do here tomorrow night it's not necessarily about solving the issue of homelessness. It is about putting you next to somebody that is experiencing homelessness so you can actually have that conversation.
Yeah.
I will just add this. There's not enough affordable housing in the city. If you make $3,000 a month, you can't afford anything in Nashville.
Yeah.
So you might be on the street, have money, and still be in a situation. The best thing to do is learn what resources are in your city. You said you about Portland. Learn what resources are in your city, and then also just have a conversation. These are people with names, with faces. Find out their name. You can awfully say, I'll pray for you, but knowing what is actually available to people is probably the best thing you can ever do for anybody.
Thanks, Mark. Way to go. Look at, and you guys are right next to each other. See that? Jesus took the wheel. Yes.
I wondered if you could speak to how we as believers don't overvalue or undervalue our skills, how we, you know, I think as a woman business owner, you know,
yeah.
I, you know, want to protect women who understand yeah. the value they bring to the table. I also know
totally.
We and a lot of our friends over the years, the word ministry has been abused to accept a lower salary because it's ministry, you know, and
totally.
And it should be the opposite, right? It should be like,
yeah,
I don't know, like
yeah.
we know you're giving out of abundance, and so we're going to give you more to
totally.
Entrust to you. So
totally.
How do we encourage that? How do we live that?
Yeah, it's so funny. Paul has, in several places, Paul talks about how ministers of the gospel can and should get their living from the gospel. Now, there are times he will not use that prerogative in order to provide social commentary against a church that overvalues that. So in Corinth, he was a tent maker and they hated him because he should be so important, he just earns a salary, but he chose the lower position on purpose to make a statement about the gospel. So one of the things he says is a worker is worth his wages. And when you look at that quote back into the Old Testament, yes, people should be rewarded for what they do. Absolutely. So I abide by something Andy Stanley once said years ago. He said, do for one what you wish you could do for everyone. So there has to be a place where, let's say as a therapist, you have a certain rate, and that rate is, it's market driven, it's like, it's what you're worth, it's what the, all the things. But then perhaps there's somebody that you see that doesn't pay that rate. And it's simply a generous thing. I don't know that you should feel guilted into taking less for the sake of ministry. I think maybe there are times when that's a legitimate ploy, but I've seen it abused too. And I really think that when Christians are dealing with money, they should be generous in how they pay, how they take care of each other, how they tip. I just think if we really believe Jesus has risen from the dead, right, we're not hoarders. Now, that doesn't mean we don't save and plan. All of that's legit. But I also think there should be a greater freedom with each other that says, well, just because you're a Christian, you should willingly take less because you're a Christian. I don't see that in the New Testament teaching. Thanks, Emily. That's really good. Anything else?
Hey.
Hey.
Sorry. Oh, yeah. Sorry. Don't hold the mic. Sorry. Second week in a row, I'm asking a question, so I feel a little vulnerable right now.
Aww. But well, don't.
I won't ask one next week. But I just wondered if you could just quickly touch again on the 10% thing. I have been told 10% my entire life. And not only that, like, that is a wider, not just the American church. I lived for 13 years in England. I mean, it's all 10%, right? And
yeah.
pastors all over
yeah.
maybe the world. I haven't
yeah.
lived in tons of places, but
yeah.
talk about that. So where, and I love what you're saying, but I also just like
yeah.
would love to
test
hear.
Test it, test it.
Yeah,
I love
just want to hear a little bit more
yeah.
because in my head, it's always 10%. And some people would say 10% specifically to the church. Anything above and beyond goes out the other.
Yeah. And then my follow-up comment would be, show me in the church writings where it says that. Because it never says that. They will have to go to the Old Testament and say, well, look at how people supported the temple system to make that argument. So There are three passages where we're talking about giving. So here's one. The disciples, as each one was able, decided to provide help for the brothers and sisters. Here's another one. On the first day of the week, each one of you should set aside a sum of money in keeping with your income. Here's another one. Now finish this work, this offering, so that your eager willingness to do it may be matched by your completion of it, according to your means. Now, those are three instances where Paul could look at Gentiles and say, give 10% of your income to the church, to this offering, and he does not. Instead, he says, according to your means, each in your heart, because the New Testament teaching on possessions is far more radical than the Old Testament teaching on possessions. The Old Testament teaching on possessions was give 10% to the Lord. The New Testament teaching, more explicitly, is the Lord owns everything. So we don't pay off 10%. Now, for some of us, according to our means, means 1%, and that's incredibly generous for us. Jesus does talk about the tithe, but he talks about it in Jewish context, and he talks about it negatively. Hey, you Pharisees, you tithe your spices, but you neglect the greater matters of the law. So don't believe me. Read the New Testament letters yourself. There is nothing that says 10% to the church. Nothing. It's far more radical than that, and it's also far more invitational than that. Does that make sense? So we in the church insert rules and formulas where there aren't any, and we do that with dating and love and romance and money and all the big topics. And it's easier to live with the rules than it is to say, it's easier to check off a percentage. Was I generous or not this year? Than it is to say, well, let me look back on what I made and where that went. Does that make sense? So, great question. All right, last one. Oh, sweetie, because you and I are going to go home together. I love your general good statements for everybody. Honey Bear, let's go to Ty real quick. Okay.
So, I know we're talking about money particularly, but I think the greatest resource we have, which is equal for everybody, and it's canned. It's got a limit. It's going to expire.
Ooh,
and that's our
that.
Time.
Yeah, good.
And so I would argue, on your example, that the time you and your family have given to the faith is probably much more important than the dollars you might have given with that six-figure salary.
Ooh. Ty. Picture this is a mic. So stupid. All right. Before we do communion, my wife has a really good, helpful comment for everyone.
That I don't feel guilty about giving.
Okay, do it.
All right. So shortly before we found out about Seth and had Seth, I had prayed, you know, sincerely to God for more patience. And for a long time after Seth was born, I felt like God gave me Seth to provide opportunities to be patient, right? And I was sort of frustrated, like, this is not what I meant. I came to realize, however, and I feel that this is the same with generosity, that what he did for me and what he continues to do for me, not just with Seth, but for other areas, and when there is a time and a need for patience, he stops me and calms me and brings me to a place of choosing. Does that make sense? He didn't give me Seth to provide more patience. In so having Seth, he now, every time, like in the car driving or in this, he gives me the opportunity to choose, am I going to be patient or not? And in that time, it's a split second, I feel like he's like, here you go, here you go. And I think that if we start thinking of that in terms of generosity, he gives us opportunity to be generous and pray, God, show me what to do in those moments. I think that's different.
Boom. And on that note, ladies and gentlemen, kids, did you start clapping for that? Yeah, I'm a mic and I'm dropping. Yeah, exactly. All right, I know, so dumb. Oh, and by the way, see, that's so generous. so good. Oh, all right, how do you transition into communion from that? Here's the thing. There's no invitation, there's no bucket to be passed. What Paul's talking about is something he calls the life that is truly life. And that's what we want to invite all of us into, is a life that actually believes that even though there are so many things that are awful happening, that God actually is who he says he is, and that will the whole thing leads to a place that is good. And because of that, we can risk, we can take steps of faith. The way that gets personified for us is just the Lord's Supper. So as always, we're going to have people up here and around the room where the Lord's Supper is provided. That is tangible evidence of the God who provides everything for us. And then also, if this is a really tender area in your marriage, with your kids, or just in life, there are prayer request cards at the stations around the room, and we'd love to pray because, you know, a 40-minute conversation does not solve all the issues attached to this. It just reminds us that there's good out there beyond what often you hear from the church. So to that end, God, would you help us to believe that you're really this good? And in response, may we be the kind of community that bears witness to you and takes care of one another well. In Christ's name, amen.